Hello, and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan, coming to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. And today on the show...
Farmers that do host the gas wells, they get compensation, but it is exactly that. It's compensation. It's money for the interruption to your farming operation.
Farmers in regional Queensland are up in arms over the federal government's approval to drill more than 2,000 wells in the area. Also,
what we require is the will and the courage of our parliamentarians to actually implement the reform that's both desperately needed and also passionately wanted by the community.
The Greens have introduced a bill to close a loophole allowing hundreds of venues in New South Wales to keep poker machines running during mandatory shutdown hours. And later today...
We should never wait for the person who's being harmed to be the change. When you've been oppressed by decades or centuries of oppression, you shouldn't be the person that has to find the solutions around that.
We learn more about being an active bystander at this year's Women of the World Festival in Gladstone. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, farmers in regional Queensland are up in arms over the federal government's approval to drill more than 2,000 wells in the area. The wells are to extract coal seam gas in the Murray-Darling region, and farmers are concerned the drilling will soon pollute the high-quality alluvial soil and the groundwater below. Liz Balmain is one of these farmers, and she shared her concerns with CRN political reporter Noah Seckham.
Unfortunately, Arrow Energy have federal environmental approval to drill 2,500 wells across their tenure, which stretches a huge distance from sort of Wandowin in the north through to Dalby and then south towards Millmerran. And we're sort of in that area between Dalby and Millmerran. And our main concern is the impacts to the groundwater in this area in particular. We have this quite amazing alluvium called the Condamine Alluvium. It's part of the Murray-Darling Basin, connected to the Condamine River. And we rely on that in this area for not only irrigating crops, but also for our domestic supplies. Dalby's got a population of 13,000 people. And on an average year, 90% of its water supply comes from the Condamine Alluvium. So the reason we're so concerned about that water resource is because it sits directly on top of the target coal measures where they want to extract the gas from. As soon as they start extracting the gas from the target coal measures below, they have to extract lots and lots of water from the coal measures because that is what's keeping the gas in place, adsorbed to the coal. And so they have to remove that water and then the gas releases. And the idea is that it travels up the well to the surface. But as soon as you change that hydraulic pressure between the two formations, the water in the Condamine Alluvium will now be higher pressure and it will want to travel down into the now lower pressure.
When Arrow Energy began their processes in 2010, were there any benefits that were sold to the community?
Jobs and royalties, the economic benefits would have to be the two that stand out. You know, because you've got to factor in as well, farmers that do host the gas wells, they get compensation, but it is exactly that. It's compensation. It's money for the interruption to your farming operations.
If you've had to put up with living near one, what is it actually like being around one of these wells?
Yeah, I can't talk from personal experience because we're not in a developed area, but in that construction phase, there is huge disruption and you can't even imagine the light pollution. They've got these huge floodlights, you know, shining into their bedrooms. And so that construction period specifically is very, very hard to cope with. And then the other thing we've become very aware of in the last probably 5 years is the phenomenon of CSG-induced subsidence.
Naturally, your community is trying to keep itself alive, but is there concern and thought for the literal flow-on effects of this gas exploration on the rest of the country?
Yeah, so obviously there is the impact to food production for a start. In our area, we are classed as priority agricultural area, and within Queensland itself, only 2.86% of Queensland is classed as priority agricultural area. And then you have also the impact of the salt that comes to the surface in this very saline coal seam gas water. So they're predicting there will be 5 million tonnes of this toxic salt that will need to be managed into perpetuity. There is still no plan for what they're going to do with this salt at the moment. It's in holding ponds across inland Queensland, and it appears the preferred option at the moment is to encapsulate it and bury it. And so that they, you know, potential areas being within the Murray-Darling Basin catchment. And we all know that barriers underground only last for so long because of things like corrosion. And so you have the risk of this toxic salt slowly leaching into the groundwaters and into the larger catchment. So there's a huge issue there.
Farmer Liz Balmain there, speaking with CRN's Noah Seckham. To hear more about the challenges the Murray-Darling faces, you can check out From Pillar to Post wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
The Greens have introduced a bill to close a loophole allowing hundreds of venues in New South Wales to keep poker machines running during mandatory shutdown hours. The proposed law would require pubs and clubs to switch off pokies between midnight and 10 a.m, a reform backed by experts, community groups and the Independent Panel on Gaming Reform. This week is Gambling Harm Awareness Week, and gambling reform advocates like Reverend Stu Cameron say the bill is a simple, evidence-based step to reduce gambling harm, with late-night gambling linked to serious financial, social and mental health impacts.
Now, look, when it comes to our political leaders, they have all the awareness they need, both at federal and state levels, around the epidemic of gambling harm that's causing a public health catastrophe across our nation, every postcode, every demographic impacted. They know all about that. They're fully aware. We have all the research that we need. And more than that, they know what it takes to prevent that harm and to reduce it dramatically. So in this week here in New South Wales, where it's Gambling Awareness Week, we need to move from awareness to action, particularly on the part of our political leaders, to implement sensible, proportionate gambling reforms, whether it's online gambling or whether it's poker machines.
The Greens have put forward a bill for some of these reforms. What evidence shows that late-night gambling, in regards to these reforms, carries the highest risk of harm?
Yeah, look, there was a study published back in 2024 conducted by Roy Morgan Research and commissioned by the Responsible Gambling Fund here in New South Wales that demonstrably shows that the earlier the hours of the morning, the greater the risk of significant gambling harm. Bottom line is there's nothing good that happens in a pokies den at 3 a.m. in the morning. And simply by reducing access, by reducing the hours that these venues are open, closing down the exemptions where you have 674 clubs and pubs across New South Wales who have the ability to trade beyond the normal operating hours, simply doing those two things will significantly reduce gambling harm and won't have any profound or any significant impact on the vast majority of the community.
I understand that some of these establishments have been operating under a kind of loophole when the current law already requires the six-hour shutdown between 4 and 10 a.m.
Yeah.
What's the issue with that arrangement, and like how does the loophole work?
Well, many years ago, hardship exemptions were introduced, allowing venues to stay longer later. And those exemptions have never been re-examined by Liquor and Gaming, by the Licensing Authority, and have just been allowed to continue into perpetuity without being reviewed. We believe that it's now got to the point where those exemptions should be closed down as a matter of course. And if there's any argument for any further exemption, we don't think there is, that they should be freshly applied for. So this is just the reality is it's an exemption that was introduced for a time that has long since passed, particularly when you recognise that poker machine losses continue to climb here in New South Wales at twice the rate of inflation and are at record levels.
And on that note, New South Wales recorded over $2 billion loss on poker machines between only April and June this year.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of personal or community consequences are you seeing behind those figures?
Yeah, well, again, here in New South Wales, the government released a prevalence study in December of last year. It was a survey of 10,000 New South Wales residents, and that found that one in five, it's a staggering figure, one in five New South Wales residents are impacted by gambling harm, either because of their gambling activity or someone close to them. That's 1.8 million people. And that's experienced through suicidal ideation, mental health challenges, domestic and family violence, crime, lost productivity, homelessness, housing stress, the list goes on. And so the cost to the community far outweighs the profits that are being earned by clubs and pubs and the taxation revenue that's being earned by the state government. Increased and record level poker machine losses equates to record level gambling harm here in New South Wales.
The polling on this reform shows, you know, majority of people in New South Wales support shutting the pokies down between those hours. So realistically, what's stopping that reform from being actioned?
Look, I mean, yeah, it's consistently, we've been surveying every 6 months for the last 2.5 years, and every time it's somewhere between 78 and 82, 83% of New South Wales residents support powering down poker machines between midnight and 10 a.m. So the community wants it. Evidence shows that it will make a really significant difference for those who are most vulnerable to problematic gambling activity. What we require is the will and the courage of our parliamentarians to actually implement the reform that's both desperately needed and also passionately wanted by the community. It aligns. So what's stopping that? Well, it's simply the power of an industry that's had New South Wales in its grip for more than six decades. The clubs and pubs lobby are cashed up. They're powerful. They have a lot of influence around Macquarie Street here in New South Wales. And they have been able to, in many respects, have politicians cowering. On both sides of politics, it has to be said, over successive governments and afraid of implementing reform. But we have got to a tipping point here in New South Wales. The community's had a gutful. They want to see sensible, proportionate reforms, not to stop people from having a punt or enjoying a night out at the club or a pub, but to actually introduce reforms that will make a real difference in preventing and reducing gambling harm.
That was gambling reform advocate and Wesley Mission CEO Reverend Stuart Cameron there, ending that story. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Armidale on 2ARM, to our listeners in Alice Springs on ACCC, and to the other side of the country on Radio Galari in Broome, Western Australia. This year's Women of the World Festival was celebrated in Gladstone, about 500 kilometres north of Brisbane, showcasing workshops and stories from local women. One session focused on how communities can help prevent violence and support others as active bystanders. Director of the Be There Group, Sian Ross-Smith, told The Wire's Eduardo Jordan, the program encourages people to step in safely when they see violence or disrespectful behaviour.
Be There group is all about the prevention of violence and harm. And so we go into communities, into workplaces, and we share what bystanders can do and say and be to be part of the change in the prevention of violence and harm.
And what motivated you to create this group?
For me and my colleague Kirsty, we had worked for over a decade in the prison systems in Queensland. And Eduardo, what worried me about that was that the damage has already been done. You know, when we respond to violence and harm, the violence has already occurred, the harm has already been done. So for me, I was really keen to do something at the other end, figure out how we can prevent this before it happens and before things escalate. You know, because in a workplace, I think we focus on physical safety. So, you know, people wear hard hats and they wear steel cap boots, and wherever we are, there's all this physical safety requirements of us. But who is looking out for our psychosocial safety? Who is making sure that we feel psychologically safe in the spaces that we go into? So really, essentially, that's what we do.
So you mentioned in the workshop here at the WOW Festival about being a bystander. So for our listeners who are unfamiliar, what's a bystander and how can we start being one of them?
Yeah, beautiful. We're all bystanders. When we walk past things, when we interact with people every day, we're bystanders to behaviours, to anything that we might see or hear or even sense. And so it's up to us what type of bystander we want to be. Do we want to be someone that calls in things when we see them? Do we want to be someone who challenges or changes the status quo? Or do we want to be someone that sends a message through our bystander inaction that we don't care enough or that we agree with what they might be saying or doing? So yeah, a bystander is all of us. It just depends on what type of bystander we want to be. Do we want to be part of the solution, part of the change, or part of the problem by not doing or saying anything?
I'll put an example so our listeners have a clearer idea, I guess. So let's say we are in the workplace and someone comes with a racist comment or, you know, an incidence of, you know, all these kind of harassments. How can we be part of the solution?
Yeah, okay, beautiful. So, you know, Eduardo, I think what we've learned over time, or what people will say to me is, oh, there's no racism here. Right? And they're looking for really overt racism, like, you know, really overt things. But more often than not, there's this veiled, people hide behind humour. It was only a joke. It didn't mean anything. For me, that's racism. That's very clear and simple racism if you tell a racist joke. And so if someone tells a racist joke in the workplace, the message that it sends to people is that we are a racist workplace, we accept this behaviour, you're not going to be safe here if you're a person that has a different background to me. And so we're sending all of those messages through the jokes that we tell in the language that we accept. So I would say to bystanders, you've got four really distinct options. You could be there now, so you could call in that joke in the time that it's told. So you could say, hey Sian, that joke wasn't cool, that didn't sound like you. Why are you telling jokes like that? Or I don't get that joke. Or you could say even things like, I would hate to see you get fired for that, and I'm pretty sure that joke's against the code of conduct. You could also be there later. So you might not call it in the moment in front of everyone else, but you might approach me later when it's one-on-one and say, hey Sian, that joke that you told, that was concerning to me. Or you might speak to everyone else in the room and say, is that the jokes that are told here? Because that really worries me. That I didn't think that was the workplace I was coming into. Or you might be able to, you know, I say to some people, you might not feel confident doing those things in the moment, but maybe in the moment you could interrupt the joke and say, hey, does anyone want a coffee? Or I'm going to get a snack. Does anyone want one? And that creates like a circuit breaker in the moment.
And why is it so important to have standbyers?
Look, I think it's so, so important because we should never wait for the person who's being harmed to be the change. When you've been oppressed by decades or centuries of oppression based on your race, your gender, your ethnicity, your sexuality, sexual orientation, all of those things, if you've been oppressed, you shouldn't be the person that has to then find the solutions around that. It should be the rest of us that are sitting in a privileged position that be the change.
That was Sian Ross-Smith from Be There Group speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan.
A different take on Australian current affairs. This is The Wire on your community radio.
Colombian-born Siley Carrero moved to Australia a year ago, balancing work with her greatest passion, playing soccer. After a workplace incident that cost her right arm, she refused to give up the game. And today, she represents Football Queensland's futsal team for athletes with a disability and works as a wellness coach. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Siley what first drew her to the sport she loves.
I've been playing football since I was like 8 years old, that's what I remember. I love soccer. I love soccer, futsal, all these kind of sport. Because I just feel when I'm playing, the time is just stop. It disappears. It's like you just enjoy the present moment, like fully enjoy. And for that reason, I really connect all my life with soccer because it's just go and enjoy and forget everything.
Now, what challenges did you face moving from playing football in Colombia, where you're coming from, to playing football in Australia?
It's a big challenge, just because the culture is different, of course. The way Colombian people play and the way Australian people play is totally different. I mean, it's not like a big difference, but in Colombian people, we are more like technique, more like dribbling, like passes. And I guess Australian is more fast doing this. Oh, they like to run a lot. Doing this is like the challenge for me also was the language. I remember when I was playing one game, one of the girls say, unlucky. And I was like, what you say? Lucky, like crazy, something like that. I was thinking like that word. I was like, what? And I couldn't understand. Like, I was like, because of course my English at the moment was not that good. And I was like, and I say to one of my friends, why'd she say, like, I'm crazy lucky? And she say, no. Like she say, like, you could do it better. Like, that's not bad. Like, you almost scored the goal. That's not bad.
Speaking of the disability, you went through a life-changing workplace injury a few years ago. How did this affect your football career moving forward?
That was a big thing for me because, as I mentioned at the start, I love soccer. I really love soccer, and at the start for me was challenging just to know how to run. Sometimes we don't think about it, but when we run, we actually moving our arms to give that strength, that power to the run. For me, it was like that moment of depression because I couldn't do it how I used to it to do it. Also because of my accident, I lost my right arm. Then all the power from this part of my body is like disappear, but now it's changing to a different strength. But it's many challenges I face at the start. Sometimes in the game, I also had challenges like to protect the ball, because when we play soccer, we usually open our arms to protect the ball. That's one of the big challenges I have at the moment, because of course with one arm, people can just take the ball off me faster. But I try to adjust my body to protect the ball.
Now, my understanding is that you are a wellness coach and you're always posting motivational things on social media in both English and Spanish. Can you please tell us a little bit more about the work that you do on that aspect?
I remember when I was at the hospital. I was like a few days there, months there in the hospital. And one day my brother came to me and say, Siley, what are you doing? Like, having this strange, you've been here in this country, like, you should post that, like, out for people to know you, like. But in that moment, I was, like, with many things in my mind. Like, I couldn't think clearly about it. Like, I couldn't do it. And I was like, no, I need to focus in recover myself. Like, I was, like, actually couldn't even walk. I was in my bed all the time there. I couldn't eat by myself. Then it was like, I wasn't thinking in that moment in like media, social media. And after, of course, I do the rehab. I got out of all this big challenge for me. I start thinking like, maybe I should do it. And then I start doing some, like I create an Instagram where I post everything about my accident or just to motivate people. And in that motivation, I start studying everything about wellness with people, talk about it, because sometimes we don't know what people is facing because we don't know what is inside. Like every person have a different challenge inside, but we don't know what is it.
Soccer player Siley Carrero there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, That's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening, wherever you are in Australia. The Wire has been produced today with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Yuggera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders, past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire came to you from 4ZZZ in Meanjin, Brisbane. I'm Mary-Kate Hannigan. As always, thank you so much for your company. And we'll see you next time on The Wire.